Commissioner Rumapp from Vallejo, California.
Present.
Commissioner Mapp, present. Commissioner Catherine Toy from San Francisco, California.
Here.
Commissioner Toy, present. Commissioner Diane Wittenberg from Pasadena, California. Commissioner Wittenberg from Pasadena, California. Commissioner Wittenberg, you unmute your mic, please.
Present.
Commissioner Wittenberg, present. Catherine Baxter from San Francisco, Sacramento, California, representing Senator Henry Stearns from Canoga Park, California, Senate Natural Resources. Ms. Baker is not present. Keith Chilino from Sacramento, representing Assemblymember Eduardo Garcia from Coachella Valley Assembly Water Parks and Wildlife. Mr. Chilino is not present. We have a quorum, six commissioners. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Perez. And also at this time, I would like to ask you to please read the clerk's opening statement, which provides information about public participation for today's meeting.
Good morning. My name is Vicki Perez, and I am the clerk of the board for the State Park and Recreation Commission. I will provide some information on how public participation will be organized for today's meeting. If you wish to make a verbal comment on items on the agenda, or if you want to, you must be using Zoom webinar or calling in by phone. If you are currently watching the webcast on calspan.org, but you want to comment, please register for the Zoom webinar or call in. Information for both can be found on the notice, agenda, or parks.ca.gov/commission. To make a verbal comment, we'll be using the raise hand feature on Zoom at the beginning of the agenda item. If you wish to speak on the agenda item, please virtually raise your hand to let us know you wish to speak. To do this, if you're using a computer or tablet, use the raised hand button. If you're calling in on the phone, dial *9 to raise your hand. Even if you previously registered and indicated which item you want to speak on, please raise your hand at the beginning of that item. If you wish to speak or if you want to speak and you do not raise your hand, your opportunity to speak could be missed. When the public comment period starts, the order of commenters will be determined by who raises their hand first. I will call each commenter by name and then unmute your device. For members of the public that call in, I will identify you by the last three digits of your phone number. We will not show a list of commenters' names. However, I will announce them three at a time so you know who is coming up next, and commenters in the queue can be ready to comment when it's their turn. Please note, you will not be appear by video when you make your comments. I would also like to remind everyone, commenters, commission members, and staff to please state your name for the record before you speak. It is especially important in this virtual meeting setting because video options will not be available to everyone. There is a 1-minute time limit for each comment. However, this time limit could change based on the chair's discretion. When you're making public comments, you will see the timer on the screen. For those calling in by phone, we'll run the timer and let you know when you have 30 seconds remaining and when your time is up. I would also like to give a friendly reminder to our commission members, staff, to please mute yourself when you're not speaking to avoid background noise. When you do speak, please speak from a quiet location. If you experience any technical difficulties, please call or text to area code 805-801-3576 or email to it@agpvideo.com so an IT person can assist you. Thank you very much. I see that Sarah Barth has joined us. I will mark her as present.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Perez. At this time, I'd like to welcome Director Armando Quintero for opening remarks. Welcome. Glad you were able to get through the digital and join us.
I apologize. I couldn't find the link. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I'd like to extend a welcome to our new Commissioner Danny Bakewell. It's so good to see you this morning. We had a really enjoyable conversation just a few days ago, and I along with my colleagues, are especially excited to have you on board and welcome this morning. This is a really important meeting today because the general plan process is fundamental to how we manage parks, how we do the planning in order to set the guidelines for how we're going to be operating parks, protecting the resources in parks, and also providing for public access and recreation. We'll be going through several processes today with our teams and staff, and it's a great opportunity to ask questions and to understand how you, as members of the public, can be engaged in how we, together with you, create a future for state parks that is truly sustainable and truly accessible to everyone. There's a couple of different topics that we'll be covering today. And toward the end of the day, I know we're going to be talking about naming and classification process, which is also something that's very important relative to how we make parks really meaningful and how we tell the full stories of parks. So thank you all for being here today. And in advance, I'd like to really thank the staff at State Parks who put together these presentations for us. And I would also like to thank all of the commissioners in advance to a pretty full schedule for today. And I so look forward to seeing you all in the near future in a park. It's so great that the curtains of COVID are lifting here in California. We're extraordinarily fortunate. And it just feels like we're entering a new era. And I'm so excited to be entering this new era with all of you. So thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you, Chair Mapp.
Thank you, Director Quintero. I couldn't have said it better. I'm so excited about not only getting back out into the world, but the chance to have a meeting in person with all of you. Very much looking forward to it. It's definitely coming soon. At this time, I'd like to open up the introductions for the park staff. I want to acknowledge those present here at this meeting: Catherine Tobias, Senior Counsel, State Parks; Tara Lynch, Chief Counsel, State Parks. Are there any other staff not included in this list that I have?
I'm Alexandra Stell, Planning Chief with State Parks.
Thank you. Great. So as a reminder to everyone, this meeting is live webcast and can be viewed at www.cal-span.org. That's www.cal-span.org. The archive video will also be available at calspan.org's website. Members of the public who want to comment on agenda items during public comment period or comment during the items not on the agenda public comment period must register for the Zoom meeting in order to receive your unique meeting ID and password. So there's one comment period, public comment period, scheduled for this meeting. It will occur after the following report, items not on the agenda. Okay, so there's one public comment period, and it will occur after the following report, items not on the agenda. So please refer to the agenda for that item. Each speaker will have 1 minute to present their comments. Please state your name before you present your comments, because the commission will only hear your voice since your video will remain muted during this time. And individual speakers may not pool their comments under one person or cede their time to another person to obtain a longer time to speak. So unless there are any objections, the agenda will remain as printed. Okay, great. At this time, I would like to welcome Alex Dell and Catherine Tobias to introduce and discuss the next few agenda items. Alex and Catherine.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Mapp. Bob, if you would mind pulling up the first presentation, we'll start with the first agenda item, general planning process. Okay. So the first presentation, good morning, commissioners, and thank you for joining us today. Over the next few commission hearings, you'll be reviewing a couple of general plans, and knowing that this is the first time for some of you, we wanted to provide some process overview. I'll be covering the general planning process and how they're prepared and what they will include and how the commission is involved, and this will be agenda items 3 and 4. Next slide, please. So I'll run through the presentation, and then at the end, we'll open it up for questions and discussions. Our department has guidelines for preparing general plans, which provides consistency for the plans we will bring to the commission. These are outlined in the planning handbook and is available on the park's website and can also be provided to the commissioners if they're interested. The handbook was last updated in 2010, and with the inclusion of the new Cornerstone document program, will be updated in the coming years. Planning efforts are also guided by the department's Planning and Acquisition Committee, which is represented by each division within the department: cultural, natural, interpretation, education, acquisition, development, enforcement, field operations. This committee sets the priorities and directs the planning efforts for all general plans. To gain a broader perspective, plans are prepared by multidisciplinary planning teams, planning consultants, and joint planning efforts with other departments and agencies. General plans are prepared with broad public input and is approved by you, the governor-appointed commission of 9 members. General plan and general plan amendments are important for many reasons, such as the need to define the purpose and visions, if there is a demand for major capital outlay, or if there are public concerns or conflicts or use regarding the unit. There may also be acquisition addition that would require a general plan amendment. Currently, there are about 74 units that do not have a general plan, and in addition, there are many that have outlived their lifespan and are in need of being amended. Next slide, please. A general plan is required for a unit of the state park system before substantial development or a major commitment of resources can concur. It fulfills the requirements of the California Environmental Quality Act, and without a general plan, the department may only undertake basic resource management work, operate existing facilities, and provide basic visitor services. The GP is the primary management guideline for a unit and sometimes multiple units, which defines an ultimate purpose, vision, and intent for management of natural and cultural resources, interpretation, recreation activities, facilities, visitor use, and services. Once adopted, general plan guide the growth and development of the properties. The general plan is the foundation for establishing goals and guidelines for resource management, development potential, and appropriate recreation activities allowed on each unit to provide compatibility and continuity to the entire park or region, as well as each management area within the park. They also guide subsequent planning efforts such as management plans and provide support for future funding requests in acquisitions, development, and operations. Next slide, please. Statewide planning and policies are informed by resource inventories, classification and naming processes, general plans, management and project plans, and environmental conditions and assessments. These items are all housed in the department's Unidata files. This diagram shows how general plans fit within the overall planning structure from the statewide planning perspective to specific project plans. A general plan follows the unit classification and guides the next level of planning, environmental studies, and monitoring programs. As I mentioned before, the planning process does need to be updated to incorporate the new cornerstone documents, the department's newest planning mechanism that came out of the transformation. And this will be part of a revision of the planning handbook and will include commission input. Next slide, please. General plans are completed 2 different ways. Internally by districts, planning and service centers, staff, or with the inclusion of consultants and stakeholders, and under the direction of staff from the planning division, service center, or districts. Dealing with certain other agencies can take place if we have a general plan or a park of mutual concern, such as properties owned by the feds but managed by state parks. Once a team is selected, a research is conducted, including identifying significant resources and management issues and determining recreation demand and visitor needs. This info helps to develop the project scope, schedule, and cost that include identifying the primary planning purpose and need, determining the methods of accomplishing plan, whether in-house or with consultants, and the required completion date, depending on if it's development-related or resource sensitivities. Then the general plan itself is developed, including the identifying and evaluation of resource sensitivities and constraints, determining recreation development potential, covering alternatives and environmental impacts, and finally the creation of a preliminary general plan draft EIR, which goes through internal review, the CEQA 45-day public review period, properties that have established a partnership with agencies, NEPA review is also required. And finally, to the commission for review and approval. Once the hearing has been conducted, we incorporate the commission's changes to the document and distribute the final general plan and environmental impact report. Next slide, please. During the entire process, our objective is to keep commissioners informed about the current planning efforts, public interest and concerns, and changes in the planning process or general plan document, and receive commissioners' feedback and input on the plans. This is done by providing project information to the commissioners, keeping the website up to date with current planning efforts and general plan details, and providing project briefings at commission hearings, public meetings, and workshops, and providing the preliminary general plans to the commission for review. Field trips to the project sites, and of course, in these times, tour videos, and finally presenting the official commission hearing for action. Most importantly, updates and presentations at the commission hearing also keep the public informed on general planning projects. Next slide, please. A robust public participation is essential to any general planning effort. Updates and presentations at commission hearings help us meet our objective to keep the public involved in the planning process, which increases our knowledge on issues and concerns for the park's resources and use patterns. This helps us develop plans based on public preference and identifying and developing stakeholders for the state park system and its individual properties. Public comments are not only collected at commission hearings, but in a variety of platforms, such as public meetings and planning workshops, stakeholder meetings and on-site reviews, newsletters, emails, surveys, and the internet, and the general plan review and comment period, the formal CEQA process. As the public's interest in our long-range planning continues to increase, we continue to look for new ways to include the public and encourage input in these planning efforts to better understand their needs and concerns. Next slide, please. During the commission hearings, you will hear a variety of agency, public, and stakeholder issues and concerns. Some of these include items like legal challenges on adequacy of the CEQA document, conflicting uses and competition for limited resources, desire for more regional planning considerations, public requests, requesting greater participation in the decision-making process, and demand for more environmental studies and monitoring, and designating open space and recreation facilities in urban areas. It will be the commissioner's responsibility to guide the department in addressing the concerns heard from the public within the relevant general plans. Next slide, please. Now that I've covered the intent of general plans, the process, and the commission role, I'd like to dive a little deeper into the content and level of detail you'll find in a general plan. A general plan will include existing conditions, such as unit classification, boundaries, topography, significant resources, facilities, land use, recreation activities, and interpretive methods. As stated earlier, it will identify the purpose and vision of the unit, why it was acquired, and the goals and objectives for managing the resources. It will also include research into the visitors' needs and recreation demand, the associated park resources, current management and operation issues, and possible opportunities suggested for the unit. Next slide, please. It will identify and discuss the various planning issues and public concerns associated with the properties, identify new facilities, management improvements, and objectives to realize the park's potential. The development and analysis of alternatives includes land zoning options, operational and resource management goals, visitor use opportunities and impacts, recreation demand and land use capacities, and any associated impact assessment. Next slide, please. Following an explicit planning process, creating alternative solutions, and finally selecting the preferred alternative that includes unit-wide and subclassification guidelines on resource management areas, management zones, interpretation and visitor experiences, and specific area guidelines for management intent, facility guidelines and operations and resource management, and any proposed management plan and recommended future studies. The environmental impact analysis gives emphasis to the potential impacts, the alternatives and mitigation measures, and any information and responses necessary to satisfy CEQA and NEPA requirements. An interactive involvement of the public and of relevant public agency staff is necessary to obtain a broad public review through the CEQA process and through the public hearing, which precedes the plan's approval by the Park and Recreation Commission. Next slide, please. It is also important to understand the level of detail you'll receive in a general plan. General plans our broad, visionary, goal-oriented document. It identifies the important natural cultural resources and indicate what the park should be in terms of the visitor's experience. It provides general guidance in the terms of resource management, land use, circulation, interpretation, concessions, and visitor services in order to achieve the vision set forth in the plan, and identifies the relationships between the park and other relevant land managers and control agencies. They describe what is being proposed and the type of facilities that are desired. There'll also be justifications for why the facility or management action is being proposed and where the facility is being recommended. A good example is that a general plan will propose a campground or a parking lot. It will identify where it should be located and might identify an up to a certain number of spots. It might show you generally where the road access road might be, but it would not get into the details of the width and exact alignment of the road and the exact number of parking spaces or camping sites. Management plans provide the more site-specific detail. Next slide, please. General plans provide guidance and implementation for the goals of the park unit. A management plan provides more specific direction on how the park projects proposed in the general plan are implemented. Management plans are usually specific to a focus or program, such as cultural resource management plan, facility management plan, or road and trail management plans. There are many more. These plans make decisions or recommendations on how proposals will be implemented and the time frame for when it would be implemented. Designate specific sites for where facilities would be located, determine specific type, size, and designs for what the actual facility will be. For example, the general plan proposes overnight facilities in the form of a family campground, identifies the appropriate zone or area in the park this could occur, could indicate the desired range or number of campsites being considered. The management plan proposes a 100-unit campground in a specific location of the park. Plan would address access roads, parking, utilities, and building designs. Management plans would also include additional studies needed to evaluate the potential for environmental impacts and effects. A general plan would identify management plans that are necessary for future implementation of the park unit's purpose, visions, and goals. Examples of subsequent specific management or development plans, such as fire management, facility development plans, interpretive facility programs, concession development, etc. Next slide, please. Okay, so that was pretty quick, so I speak way too fast, but hopefully you found the overview of general plans useful. I know that you probably have questions, so I'm going to turn it back over to the commission chair for any questions or discussions.
Thank you so much for that overview. Very, very appreciated, and it's something I'm looking forward to engaging with more. So now I guess we will move on to the next item in the agenda, the commission's role in the general plans process, agenda item number 4.
Sorry, Commissioner Chair. That presentation already had both the agenda item 3 and 4. And so we were going to open it up for any questions that the commissioners might want to discuss about the general planning process and their role in that process.
Okay, thank you. Well, now we would like to open it up to questions from the commissioners about the general plans process and their role in the process.
You know what, Madam Chair, I might suggest to Alex, do you want to do my presentation and then talk about it in general so that they have the full CEQA side of it too?
I think that would be fine if that's how the commission would like to proceed.
I think that would be fine. I think we're moving along nicely, and perhaps the questions may come after we get the full overview.
So could I see my slide presentation, please, Bob? Next slide. So I have kind of combined both the CEQA presentation and how to delve into a general plan and an EIR, both for commissioners who may be new to this process and for the public who may be listening. I always like to start my CEQA presentations with the purpose of CEQA, because I think as you consider the CEQA document, it is really important to keep coming back to what the the actual purpose of the statute is. So the CEQA helps the commission establish environmental protection policies. It requires disclosure of import of environmental impacts. It requires agencies to avoid or reduce environmental damage, and I apologize for the typo, that is feasible. It fosters interagency coordination, enhances public participation, and it requires agency decision makers to explain the reasons why they allow environmental damage to occur. So that last point is done by the commission making certain findings at the end of the process. And you will see when you get to the resolutions that there are findings that are related to the general plan that require you to use your independent judgment as you look at the document. You are going to certify that that you understand that there may be significant effects resulting from the project that cannot be mitigated or avoided. And thus, if they stay at a significant level, you will be making what's called overriding findings, which means that you can accept that there will be significant effects from the project, but that because of the benefits from the project, you are going to choose to go ahead and approve the project. And I'll say a little bit more about some of these as we go on. To me, the most important one here, if you could pick one over the others, is the disclosure of environmental impacts. I think it's really important that the agency that is certifying a final EIR is basically showing what the impacts are associated with the project. And so I guess from a legal standpoint, that's the most important. You may find that others of these are something that you want to keep in mind as you read the documents, both the general plan and the EIR. And so I hope you'll use this slide as kind of a touchstone to come back to. Next slide. So CEQA is what's called a procedural statute, and that means that it does not mandate a result. So the CEQA statute basically describes the process that we use to consider environmental impacts. And that means that you will not be dealing with a prescribed result. So if the project has environmental impacts that either can't be mitigated or that are mitigated or avoided, you can still approve the project, you can deny the project. And it's important to understand, and I know we have a lot of pretty experienced people here on the commission today, but I know we also have some people who really, you know, are not familiar with the CEQA process, but it's important to understand that that there are two processes going on here. One process, and I always like to think of these as railroad tracks. One process is the general plan process, and one process is a CEQA process. So just because you certify an EIR as adequate to be used as the baseline for the project decision does not mean that you have to approve the project. They are two separate documents and two separate processes. So it's important to understand, and a lot of times I think citizens in particular may not be totally clear on this, is that when you get comments that say, please don't approve this EIR, the correct response to that is tell us what your problem is with the EIR, because the EIR at some point does get to a point of adequacy and should be certified. Whether or not you approve the general plan is a separate decision. So we don't aim for technical perfection, but we do want informed decision making. So CEQA uses a standard of reasonableness, which is also really important to keep in mind. The focus is on physical impacts, and I'll talk a little bit about this at the end of the talk. The CEQA does not get into economic impacts unless they are a result of a physical impact. So we look for reasonable analysis, not perfect, not speculative, and not exhaustive. Next slide, please. So the roles in CEQA are that an agency, or in this case, the department, will compile a baseline of information. The commission is going to use its independent judgment to certify that document. The community is going to hopefully attend all our briefing meetings to get a really good handle on what the project proposes and what the impacts are. They're going to contribute their opinions and additional information if they have any. And then the consultants are our technical experts who prepare the EIRs, and of course the courts settle disputes if there are any. Next slide, please. So just a couple of definition terms. CEQA, of course, is California Environmental Quality Act, excuse me, or CEQA, but usually just CEQA. The lead agency in this case, who is responsible for preparing the project, is or who is responsible for approving the project, sorry, is the State Parks and Recreation Commission. We prepare programmatic EIRs, and I'll discuss that later, for general plans. So that is prepared by the department for the SPRC. You'll hear reference to thresholds, which are standards used to compare impacts, and I'll talk a little bit more about those later. And the alternatives that are used in CEQA are used to compare and contrast other options to the proposed project. You will not necessarily be choosing an alternative to the project. They are really more to show you what other choices there are besides approving the proposed project. Next slide, please. So CEQA in general is triggered by a discretionary decision that has the potential for a significant environmental impact. The law requires cities and counties to prepare an EIR for a general plan. State parks, it's not specified, but state parks prepares a programmatic document for our general plans. And what that programmatic document allows us to do is to basically look at our parks, if you will, from a 30,000 foot level. So what we're trying to do in the general plan level is we're trying to consider what areas should be used in the park, what areas might be better left as a reserve or preserve, such as archaeological areas, areas of some cultural significance, biologically sensitive areas such as a wildlife corridor or an environment that provides habitat for endangered species. We also have a new document that Alex referred to briefly, which is called the Cornerstone document. And those documents are even higher level, if you will, above the 30,000 feet. They really just give us a quick glimpse of what the park will operate as. And because they don't really specify any action, they generally will not trigger CEQA. So I use that as an example just to basically point out that, you know, we do have documents that don't get CEQA. We have this document, the programmatic EIR, that goes to the commission. And then we have the department actually approves the management plan and projects. So you may not see other EIRs going through the department because the commission just has responsibility for the general plan and not the other projects that tier off of the general plan. So that programmatic document provides our baseline for the whole general plan, and it's your opportunity to really put your input into how that park should develop, because you will not generally be seeing other projects that follow. So next slide, please. So staff thought that might be helpful for some of the commissioners and public who have not looked at a general plan before or have not looked at an EIR. And so this is a little bit more just guidelines for people who have not had that experience before. I know a number of you probably seen more than your share of CEQA documents or general plans. So I encourage people to always read the summary and the project description. The summary should give you an overview, as it sounds like, and will basically tell you some of the major issues, the controversial issues. It will give you an introduction to what types of things we're hoping to cover in the general plan and the EIR. And then when you're looking at the general plan, you do not have to open the general plan and read straight through. I recommend that people who don't have a familiarity with a general plan or an EIR for that matter, that basically pick a subject that you either do have some expertise in or that you're just interested in. If you enjoy the history and archaeology, that's often a relatively easy place to start. Because it's something that a lot of people have been exposed to. Science was one of your interests, the biology section is a good one to start with. If you have an interest in water, then the water quality or water supply areas of the general plan are a good place to start. But, you know, back to the project description, if you are totally confused after you read the project description, one way to kind of check the project description is to turn to the alternatives and learn what other choices staff and the consultant have presented to you. And so you have a compare and contrast situation at that time where you can basically see what the proposed project is by looking at what the other choices would be for the general plan. So that's one way to basically, you know, kind of get started in it. The documents, you know, have as little jargon as we can, you know, try to allow in a document. But like any area of expertise, it has certain, you know, words that reoccur. Most of our documents have definitions in the front of the document, which will define them. You know, an easy way to start reading is just to be ready to circle things that you don't understand. Rather than getting bogged down in a chapter where you don't understand some of the terminology, just circle it and keep reading, because the more familiarity you have with the information, the more it's going to start to make sense. So don't let yourself get bogged down at the start. Just circle it, and then later you can come back on a second reading and look at the definitions and start filling in the blanks for yourself. Next slide, please. So you may want to visit a park yourself that's being considered for a general plan. Of course, pre-COVID, we took you out to the parks and gave you a tour. For the upcoming ones, we have virtual tours, which have worked very well to introduce the commission and the public to the park that's under consideration. But one of the things you might want to keep in mind is, you know, ask yourself what kind of park it is. Is this a park that's kind of centered around historic resources? Is it a park that's mostly habitat and, you know, trees and native plants and things like that that's been set aside for the public to enjoy? And then think about how you would use that park. Are you a camper? Are you a person who likes to walk in the park? Are you a kayaker? You know, so kind of try to place yourself in the park and think about what other visitors to the park might expect or what they might be expecting to see. And kind of try to immerse yourself in that situation. One way to do that is to start with the visual section. That tells you what the park looks like in case you haven't been able to see it. And it tells you what it will look like in the future if we're adding facilities or if some other changes are being made to the existing visual resources. Once you've read a chapter or two, flip back to one of the chapters you've read and start looking at it a little bit more critically. Next slide, please. So let's say you read the biology section and you start with reading some of the first goals and objectives. So one of the questions you're going to ask yourself is, do they match? Do those objectives seem to you with your expertise, you know, such as it is, because we value everybody's expertise, whether you have, whether you know a lot about general plans or a lot about parks, or whether you're just, you know, representing the people of California, some of whom use the parks all the time and some of whom never get to a park. So we're not expecting you to have a lot of specialized knowledge to read these, because the citizens generally won't have that knowledge either. But ask yourself, do the objectives move the goal along to accomplish something? We try as hard as possible to, or I should say as much as possible, to figure out ways to implement our goals. But you're going to want to look at those objectives, excuse me, and see if you have ideas on other ways that we could implement those goals. Or do the objectives seem to you to make sense? What would you expect to see if state parks identified a wetland or a wildlife corridor? Would you expect us to leave that wildlife corridor in place? Would you expect us to put that into a preserve that would be somewhat segregated from the rest of the park in terms of visitor access? So you kind of want to insert yourself into this general plan. And if it doesn't make sense to you initially, you know, with the connections between the general plan, I mean, the goals and objectives, then that's something that you may want to, you know, talk to the director about, so that, you know, we can get you some help in trying to basically kind of interpret these sections. So it is a little bit daunting to start in on some of these sections. But basically, you need to just keep reading. So again, circle and read. Don't get bogged down. Just keep moving. You can come back and start reading once you've kind of had more experience in reading the whole things. Our objectives and our goals should be straightforward. We do try to minimize our jargon, but you know, there are certain assumptions that are made about some of the more technical chapters, biology, archaeology. And that's something that you'll want to check. There's always a bibliography in the back of these documents that will lead you to other resources. If you really are interested, for example, on archaeology, but you're having trouble following it. And of course, you know, I know it's not always the considered a high source, but, you know, I find Wikipedia very helpful for some of these types of things where you can, you know, kind of look up some references that may at the moment be a little bit more confusing to you. Next slide, please. Once you're comfortable with one section, go on to the next one. Basically, you're going to see, if you look at the table of contents with a general plan, you're going to see that the sections are listed in some sort of order. That's not always indicative of anything. I kind of like my general plans to start with the most significant sections, but sometimes we just start with land use, for example, because it's kind of a basic chapter, and we go on to water, or we go on to air, or archaeology, or whatever. So the table of contents will basically give you an idea of what's covered and, you know, and how it's covered. But it's just a guide. And if the subject matter doesn't interest you very much, then leave it to the last or wait for staff to explain it. It's, you know, there's no point in starting to put the document down because you're not interested in it. We'd rather you go back to a section that you are interested in and really understand it from the beginning to the end. Of course, we would like you to look at the whole general plan and the IR, but you know, we also know realistically that you have other jobs and that, again, for some of you, this may be your first time going through this. But what's really important is that you need to have a good grasp of what's in the general plan because, next slide, you are going to be certifying that you have used your own independent judgment to certify this EIR. And by certifying it, it means that you're going to find that it's adequate for decision making, that it has enough information in it for you to make an informed decision. And then you are going to be certifying that the significant impacts have either been reduced or mitigated or avoided or the project has been changed to avoid those impacts. So it's really critical that you have some understanding of the general plan and of the programmatic EIR. Next slide, please. So the EIR is kind of read the same way that the general plan is. Find a subject that you're interested in and read that first. I would start with the summary again because it's very basic and it just takes you through what you're going to be reading. This time, instead of looking at the goals and objectives and the connection between the goals and objectives and the project description on how we're carrying out a general plan, you're going to be looking at the connection between the proposed project, which is the programmatic EIR, the impact analysis, and the connection between the existing setting and the impact analysis to see whether there is a potential for significant effect. I think one of the things you'll notice in our EIRs is that because we're a land management agency and not a developer or a facility-based agency, we have a lot of ways to design our parks. We don't need to maximize the amount of land, such as a developer might in terms of siting houses or commercial facilities on a piece of property. We don't have to maximize that amount of land to make a profit. If we've got an area that is not a good place for the public to go, then we're probably going to move our facilities away from that area to avoid that. Next slide, please. So you're going to see various chapters in the EIR: biology, archaeology, water quality, land use. And there's two ways to write the EIRs. You can either have a chapter that goes through both sections of an EIR. So for example, in a biology section, you would have the existing setting, which tells you what is there at the moment. That's our baseline. And then you, following that existing setting, you would have an impact analysis, which tells you that if that project is approved, what kind of impact would you have on the biology of the area? Would you be impacting a stream? Would you be, as I said before, impacting habitat, a wildlife corridor? And then you're going to have a section that basically tells you whether there is no significant impact, whether there's the potential for significant impact, but it's been mitigated, or whether there's significant impact that cannot be mitigated and cannot be avoided and remains a significant effect. The other way the EIRs are written is that you have the whole first part of the document is existing setting, and you'll have under existing setting, you'll have biology, water quality, air quality, transportation. Then there'll be a second section, and that will be the impact analysis. And then again, it will go through those various sections. So that's why it's kind of important to just kind of flip through the EIR initially and just see how it's organized and how you're going to be reading it. The thresholds that I referred to early on are the standards by which we measure whether something has an impact or not. So let's take a vernal pool as an example. Can I see the next slide, please? So let's say, for example, that you we're doing a state park in Sacramento County that has a number of vernal pools. And a vernal pool is a particular type of habitat that is based on the type of soil that's present, the amount of drainage that's present, certain types of plants and sometimes animals that live in that vernal pool. The vernal pool generally develops in the spring with the rains and then dries out and can hardly be seen sometimes in August by the time all the vegetation is dry. So in one of the areas in Sacramento County and Prairie City, we have the park is located in an area that has a number of vernal pools. And so what we've done in that park is we have preserved areas that have vernal pools. However, the vernal pools in this area are pretty extensive. And so we had the opportunity to really preserve the ones that are really important and significant, but we did not necessarily have to preserve all the vernal pools in the area. Conversely, if you're in a county that does not have very many vernal pools and the area that you want to look at for a park is in the area of the only vernal pool in that county, then you're going to have a very different situation than if you're in South Sacramento County that has a number of vernal pools. You're going to want to preserve that vernal pool. You're going to want to do everything you can to preserve the drainage around that vernal pool, and you are going to want to direct your development everywhere else. So when you read a threshold, that threshold should tell you how valuable that resource is. It will tell you this is a large area of vernal pools that vary from significant to insignificant, or it'll tell you that the loss of even one vernal pool or any vernal pool in that county would be significant because it's the only vernal pool or the only area of vernal pools that they have. What we would do in that situation and what we did in the park that that I'm referring to is we basically, you know, fenced that area off and it is not used as an active part of the park. It is a buffer area and it, you know, it basically preserves that area of vernal pools. So in that case, we were able to avoid using that area. And so what might have been a significant impact is reduced to a level of no significance because we kept the vernal pools in place. So that's basically what the thresholds do is they provide you the measurement of how important that habitat or that particular area is. Next slide, please. So if you're short on time, you might not have time to get to the all the chapters. Please make sure you look at the summary. And you may want to turn to the back of the document, use the table of contents, but you may want to go to the section that basically is entitled Significant Impacts That Cannot Be Mitigated. It's important to know which impacts cannot be mitigated because, again, you will be making legal findings on this issue. And you will be able to ask staff at the time of the presentation what, you know, why we couldn't mitigate certain significant impacts or, you know, how we came about that decision. So that's something that is important to focus in on. Next slide. So what aren't community or what aren't environmental impacts? And Alex referred to this shortly as well. One of the issues you'll hear about, probably hear about in our general plans is often the roads that are used to get to specific areas of the parks. In a lot of cases, these are county roads that are mostly used only by the residents of the area. You may see a lot of people very concerned about the number of visitors who may be using those roads. But the community angst about that, you know, is something that is not an environmental impact. Certainly, we do evaluate the use of the roads, but often those roads have a lot of capacity because they're in very isolated areas. So there's usually quite a lot of traffic that can be added to those roads without ever triggering a significant impact. You may also hear people say that their property value is going to be affected. That's, again, not a CEQA or environmental issue. It's certainly a valid issue to that property owner, but it's also something that is very hard to quantify. Economic impacts are generally not covered in most environmental impact reports. A shift in policy where we tend to favor one thing over another that was favored in the past. quality of life, fiscal impacts to the agencies, not environmental impact. And so all of these can be very real policy issues and may be covered in the staff report that you receive. They're just not CEQA issues. So one of the things that's important with the citizens and what that we work hard on in our briefings and also in our hearings is to really help citizens differentiate among these different areas. So you may see, once we do we present the general plan and EIR to you, the citizens have a chance to write comments back to us on their concerns about the project. We will then answer those concerns, and there will be published a final EIR as opposed to the draft EIR that will answer those comments. So you may see comments in the EIR that just say, I don't want this project because it's going to disturb the tranquility of the area I live in. That's a comment on the project, but it is not a comment on the general, on the EIR. And so, as I say, we do work hard to try to help citizens make appropriate comments. We want to hear all their comments. They just need to understand that whether they're commenting on the EIR itself or whether they're commenting on the proposed project, which is the general plan. And that goes back to that, my railroad example of keeping in mind that there are really always two processes going on, the general plan and the EIR. So I think that's all I had on how to basically kind of enter into getting familiar with general plans and EIRs. So I think we can open it up to questions at this point. And I'm done with that presentation.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Tobias and Ms. Stell. This was great. As long as I've been on the commission, I'm still learning. And some of the tips that you offered about how to eat the elephant, right, of the plan, one bite at a time, was very helpful. So thank you for those tips. I just want to make sure that we're aligned on where we are with the agenda before opening it up for questions, because you covered a lot of ground. So we are between agenda items 6 and 7. How to read general plan with tools provided, and then resolution process is next. Or did you incorporate that as well?
Correct. Resolution process agenda item 4 or 5 is next. So we
okay.
Just
great.
With the agenda. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Just want to make sure I'm sunk up with you. So at this time, I think it is a great time to break for questions. And then I also want to offer that we take a break from the screen at 10:30. So given that we have the resolution process, I just want to make sure that maybe we have enough time for questions and some discussion before going into the resolution process. And then after that, we can take a break. Does that sound agreeable and reasonable to you?
Yes.
Everyone, commissioners? Okay, great. So now for questions.
No question. I just want to echo what Commissioner Mapp said earlier. As a new commissioner, I really appreciate the tips and tricks to get it done, to go ahead and tackle my first general plan proposal. So thanks very much to both of you for presenting that information.
I echo that. And I do have, I think it's two questions. The first is, I think I need a little more clarity on, does the general plan, when we're looking at the general plan, is that the document that shows us potential multiple proposals for a park? Or, so for example, you know, if there are options for an accessible pathway to a stream, and then there are other options to get to that pathway, do we see that those options in the general plan? And then does that draft EIR show the impacts of each of those options?
That's a really good question. Alex, do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Go ahead, tackle it.
Okay. So that is an excellent question, because there is often a lot of people would ask the same question. So one of the things that we do when we start working on a general plan is we do have a lot of choices. We have a lot of ways of citing the facilities we need to put in there. We're going to do surveys that show us, you know, where the endangered species are or where a stream is, and whether that stream is easily accessed or whether it needs a bridge, those kinds of things. So early in the process, during the first workshops, you're going to see a pretty open-ended presentation. And that, for to answer your question that you posed, you'll see, you know, maybe different ways of handling the stream. Do we want people to get down to the stream and basically be able to play in the water? Or is that really kind of a habitat for certain types of critters and we really don't want people in there, but we want people to enjoy it? So basically it'll have a bridge across it. As we go through these workshops with the public, we will start honing down into what's called a proposed project. So by the time you get to the end of the general plan process, we will have what's called a proposed project. And that project will be what we want to propose to you and to the public in terms of the choices we've made on how you access various areas. So, and then in the CEQA process, once we have that proposed project, and for CEQA, we need a stable and finite project description. So we need to know enough about that project description that we can analyze it. So we will go through and we will basically analyze that proposed project. Let's say we decide on a bridge because there's really, it's just going to cause a lot of damage to the stream to have everybody kind of trooping down to the stream and then climbing back out of it to get to the other side. And we don't want to, it's too difficult to get people in and out of that area or for various reasons. So that part of the proposed project would show that what we want to do is build a bridge across that stream, and it would analyze the what will happen when you build a bridge. So, you know, how much construction would there be in the stream? Is there a better place to build that bridge than where we initially looked at it? You know, is it a shorter bridge? Is it a longer bridge that allows people to enjoy the stream habitat more, again, because they can't get down in it? So there's all kinds of considerations with that. Then in each chapter, you will also see a consideration, well, sorry, not in each chapter, but at the end, you will see a consideration of alternatives. So CEQA requires that we do the alternatives to the project at a slightly higher level than the proposed project. NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which is the document or the statute used for federal projects, has a different approach. It takes the proposed project and then it takes the alternatives and follows the proposed project and the alternatives all the way through the document at the same level of consideration. But CEQA does not do that. CEQA basically has you do the whole proposed project, and then at the end, it evaluates the alternatives. So if commissioners are interested, they could certainly attend these initial briefings, which will get you in on the ground floor of how the project's developing. Or you can ask those questions when the general plan gets to you at the final analysis. And you can say, you know, I'm really concerned that the people can't get down to the stream. I really, you know, I love being by a stream. I love being able to kind of see, you know, what's going on in that area. And then you can ask staff and they will explain to you how, you know, how that proposed project was chosen. Does that answer your questions?
Yes. I worked with NEPA before, so that was really helpful.
Perfect. Okay, great. Great.
Great. We have a couple more, actually three more hands. I'm not sure who was first. I see Commissioner Ginsburg, Commissioner Barth, and Commissioner Toy. Maybe we move in that order, if that's agreeable to you. Oh, and Commissioner Wittenberg, your hand is up as well? Okay. If in that order we can ask questions, that'd be great.
Thank you, Commissioner Mapp, and thanks everyone for the presentations. I was just wondering if we could do a little bit more on the interplay between the general plan and the management plan. It's clear that management plan is a sort of a department produced and sort of department approved document, but to what extent do we, you know, review, reflect on the management plans when reviewing the general plan? Because it sounds like a lot of the operational issues are really located in the general plan. I mean, in the management plan, sorry.
Right. So when you think of a general plan, you know, that's typically, you know, there. So not to confuse the issue, but there is new legislation now that we can actually have management plans without having a general plan. But typically we'd like to have a general plan first, and then our management plans are tiered off of that general plan. So a management plan needs to stay consistent with the general plan. So like when Catherine, as she presented, you're looking at a general plan, which is like that 30,000 foot level. And an example would be, you know, that as was just discussed, we might want to have an ADA accessible trail and a bridge down around a stream. And we would stay that in the general plan. In a general plan, we'd like to have this ADA trail. We'd like to have it in this general location. We'd like to have this bridge over the stream to provide public access. And that might be the extent of the evaluation in a general plan. And then the road and trails management plan might actually get more specific on the actual alignment, where we flag that route. It's been evaluated by, you know, specialists to make sure any natural or cultural resources are being avoided, and gets down to that project level detail, you know, really looking at proposing how we're going to build that bridge, you know, how wide it's going to be, you know, where the footprint's going to be, you know, how the trail ramp is going to be ramped up to the bridge, you know, all those, the access point, the trailhead. So the management plans get really more into the specifics and than the general plan. So typically when you're looking at a general plan, the management plans haven't been done yet. You're looking at the general guidance for the parks and the goals. And then later we take these management plans to achieve those goals, right? You know, if you say you want an ADA trail in this location, then I'm going to go to a road and trail management plan and try to figure out how we can make that happen with minimal impact. And there's another level of review. Whatever's not covered by the general plan in the environmental review does get covered project level environmental review. So it becomes a tiering process. Catherine, is there anything you want to add to that?
I think that was well put.
Does that answer your question, Commissioner Ginsburg? Right.
Commissioner Barth?
I think related questions. One is, as the commission is asked to review and offer opinions on these, are you looking for a yes or no? Or is there, you know, the opportunity to say yes with conditions? And then the related question is, we have some general plans that are coming before us soon. And obviously for folks like me who are new to the commission, we weren't involved in earlier discussions about those, presumably for, you know, general plans that are starting the process now, we will be involved or have the opportunity to engage in workshops or other public meetings. For those plans that are going to be before us that are well on their way, is there opportunity to review some of those materials or hear more about what the public had to say, for example? I know sometimes those kinds of things are included, but in particular, some of the early info would may be helpful. So, thank you.
So Commissioner Barth, you could not have led into some information that I wanted to share with the commission any better. So, you know, we do actually have a web page that's been established for each of our general plan projects in process. And for the and typically it will be, you know, so what we'll do is we can send you guys a link to the relevant general plans that you're currently reviewing. And those pages have all the background information. And every step that we have taken in the planning process, we'll have information about relevant workshops, stakeholder meetings, comments that have been received. You know, it'll have the first draft plan, the next draft plan, and, you know, it really has all the relevant documentation. So if you really wanted to go back to the beginning of the story, you could. So typically those are on our general plan park pages, and if you click on any relevant general planning project, you will see that information associated with the, and actually we sometimes provide it for our past planning efforts. So you would see it all the way up to the final general plan and EIR. And as we get closer, so what we'll do for the next couple of general plans, we'll send you those links so that you can have easy access to them when we send you any additional information in regards to the those specific plans. So that is available, yes.
And we will, when we do the presentation of the general plan to you, what you'll see, what the commission will be focusing on primarily are the areas that are in contention. So, as a general plan develops, we often get to a point where, people are supportive of one concept, but not of another. So you will see in the staff report that there will be a discussion that attempts to kind of focus you down on those areas of dispute. So with respect to your question of, is there a yes or a no to the projects? What you'll be listening to is you'll be listening to the citizens talk about what they would have liked in the general plan or what they don't like about the general plan. And then you will be asked to approve a proposed project. You can approve the project as staff proposes it. You can approve the project by changing it. You can basically, we've never had anybody do this, but you could send it back and say, we don't think there's enough information on this particular part of it. And then the reason that you're going to read the EIR with the general plan is that's going to be telling you what environmental impacts are associated with it. So you'll be able to distinguish between what's an environmental impact under CEQA and what might be a neighborhood concern or a regional concern, or sometimes a city or county may not be happy with the way that we've basically proposed a portion of the general plan. So yes, you can, at times, and again, I don't remember this happening too much, is that you may want to take one of the alternatives that's been proposed and substitute it in. And of course, just in like any normal meeting with Robert's Rules of Order, you would eventually be making a motion to approve the project, but with a substitution of, let's say we proposed a bridge, but people really want to get down to that river. You could basically say, I would like to see this change to an ADA accessible area and not just have, a bridge that doesn't allow people to get down to the water. So we would have to basically take that into account, perhaps go back and discuss it. We might come back to you and say, there's just no way to get people down to the water in that particular area. We've changed another portion of the general plan to be able to access a more riparian habitat somewhere else in the park. And we're going to propose that you approve this plan, as we've adjusted it. So does that answer your question about the yes and no? Okay, great.
I did also want to mention that when we send you the link, the initial link to the general plan, which you received, for the upcoming general plan at the end of the month for review, you received a link to that preliminary general plan. We actually pull out one of the chapters, which is the revisions to the general plan. That those are the revisions that were adjusted after the formal public review comment. And we pull that out and provide it to you so that you should be looking at that while you're going through the general plan, because that will show you the changes that we've made to accommodate the comments that we received. And so it's a nice tool for you to read side by side so that you can see how we've made those adjustments.
Great. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Commissioner Toy.
Thank you. I had a question about community and public engagement that goes into the process. And I was wondering if someone could tell us a little bit more about what kind of community engagement is done, to go into even the first draft before it even hits public comment, if any. And then in the public comment period, what kind of outreach is done, in both these things? Is it proactive or reactive? And sort of what's the balance on that?
It's both. So when we come up with it, so when a general plan, so when our planning and acquisition committee identifies a general plan that they would like to have initiated, a park unit that they would like to have a general plan and, or amendment initiated, we go out. One of the first things we do after we go through the standard planning processes, setting up a project, is we go out and do scoping meetings with the public and our stakeholders. And we do that right off the bat before we even start with developing concepts or alternatives. We start with those conversations with the public. We host, we look at different ways that we can interact with the public as far as, do we need a visitor? Maybe we need some visitor surveys conducted at that location. You know, should we be doing those in person? Should we be doing them online? You know, how can we reach the largest audience? Are there stakeholder groups or advocacy groups in those parks, like a Friends of group that we should be connecting with? Are there partner agencies or, you know, other major landowners that we should be connecting with? So we try to do all that homework and get kind of identify those players early on. And then we hold these stakeholder and scoping meetings and community outreach meetings. And while we do that, we continue to collect contact information, because we'll have people who want to be notified just about what's happening at this specific park. And then we have folks who want to be notified about all of our general planning processes. And so we have two lists. So we send out e-blasts to the folks who are interested in everything that State Parks is doing on the planning level. And then we also compile a list specific to just a certain general planning effort. And as we move through the process, we continue to update those folks whenever we're going to have meetings, whenever we have drafts that are ready for review. And then of course it becomes, you know, a secular process, right? We get more lists, more names, and it continues to grow. So after scoping meetings, when we start working with designing things like concepts, and basic, you know, some basic plans, we then go back out to the public again and share that again. This is what we heard in our stakeholder meetings and our scoping meetings. This is now what we're proposing. And we go through that process all over again with the public. And we do that proactively. We also are reactive in the fact that if a group calls us or there's concern, we will go and meet with those groups individually, or we'll create a workshop or a meeting where we can have multiple stakeholders or people of interest join us and have those conversations with them as well. So we go through that process again when we get our concepts. Once we start selecting alternatives and we once again, work with the public. And then once we get to that point when we have what our preferred alternative is, that's what goes into the CEQA document. And then that goes out for formal review, which is which requires us to respond to the comments that we receive. So during that formal review, up to that point, we are, you know, we're interacting with the public and we're responding to them in conversations, but we're sometimes sending out notices of how we've addressed certain comments that we received. But when we get to that public review formal process, we have to respond to every comment we receive, and we have to show that response, how we responded, either by a revision in the document or a justification of why that revision or a revision wasn't made. And that becomes part of that final EIR documentation. And then once we get to that point, we're back at the commission. And all through this process, we are also at the commission's with public presentations, updates, presentations, and that also provides the public formal time to comment to the commission and to staff on any ongoing concerns or desires that they might have about those individual planning efforts. Catherine, is there anything you'd want to add to that?
I think the only thing I would add is that probably the public participation process is what's changed the most with general plans over the years. Some of our early general plans are 5 pages, and maybe their environmental impact report is 3 pages. These are our really early ones from the 70s when we were just getting going with CEQA. Our general plans generally have in the past generally stayed in place for anywhere from, you know, 5 years to 30 years, and some of them are much older than that. I expect that to change a little bit because the parks are becoming a little bit more urban. They touch more urban areas. They are relied upon for more than sometimes the original state parks intend. Hopefully in the future, there'll be a little bit more of a living document, as opposed to a shelf document. But the public participation aspect has probably changed the most in terms of how we do the general plans. Generally, our staff people are experts in their field. We have a number of different areas of expertise represented in our staff. Generally, people tend to be, you know, pretty well-versed in their area. You know, people have master's degrees and PhDs in archaeology or you know, whatever area that they are hired to work in. And so I think, you know, in the old days, we kind of felt that our staff was able to decide what should be in a park and in general park based on their expertise. You know, now, of course, you know, times have changed and, you know, we rely a lot more on going out to the citizens, finding out what they want in the parks and trying to respond to that. So it's a more of a blend of the expertise that parks brings to the general plan, plus the interest areas that the public brings to us in terms of what they would like to see in the parks.
And I think it should be noted, you know, we get a lot, obviously, right, in any planning process, you get a lot of interaction with the public. There's a lot of desires in a park. And one of the biggest, you know, we'll talk about this a little later in our workshop. One of the biggest challenges for us, of course, is making sure that any of those actions or recommendations, you know, the goal is, of course, they all have to stay consistent with the classification of the park. Classification of the park outlines for us in the Public Resources Code what we can and cannot do in that park. And we have to take those comments and balance that and the requests that we get from the public and balance that with those classifications.
Thank you for that. I just want to make sure that I've got Commissioner Wittenberg, who's been patiently waiting, and then Commissioner Mahdi has a question. So, and I did want to just put a pin in a possible clarification of how tribal communities are worked with and considered as part of the plan. I think of the general public, but I also think about the tribal communities and if there's a standard way that the engagement happens there. But we can put that in the parking lot, but I'd love to hear more about that. Commissioner Wittenberg.
Okay, thank you. I have several questions, but hopefully they're quick. So we've always had this problem in past reviews of general plans that commissioners and the general public expect the general plan to be more of a management plan in some cases on issues that they want. And that dichotomy of they want more specifics or we want more specifics is never met. So we talked for several years about changing the general plan process to more, as you mentioned, Alex, management plans, so that level of granularity would be reached. Do you anticipate we're going to have that same general plan frustration in this process here, or it'll be more granular?
I would think that you'll always have that frustration. People, you know, folks want to see, they want to hear the details of exactly what's being put on the ground. And there's that, sometimes it's very difficult to understand that we have to get through this. First, we have to be able to identify the goals and objectives, the purpose, vision, and goals of this park unit before we can get down to those project, very detailed project level objectives.
And then it's important to basically compare it to a city or county general plan. You know, there is a lot of survey work to be done before a park is developed. It's very costly because when it gets down to, as you said, and that's a good word, the granular level, you know, it would basically mean that we would be surveying very large parks in some cases, you know, at a very detailed level. And that's just not economical or expeditious. So the idea of the general plan is to basically provide guidance, to give you some idea of what areas would be off limits, what areas might be good for further development. And so as Alex says, yes, that is always going to be a push and pull type of issue for both the commissioners and the public. But I think it's important to understand that there is a reason that the cities and counties have general plans, and then they have, I'm blanking on the next plan down, a regional type of plan or a plan.
Transportation plans, yeah.
Yeah. And then you finally get down to the zoning, and you finally get down to building permits. And, you know, that process exists for a reason. And so it's important to understand that the management plans and any plans below a general plan have to stay consistent with the general plan. And so that's your guarantee, both as commissioners and for the public, that once you set the general plan in place, it will be followed. But we cannot do that granular level at the very beginning, unless it's a really tiny park that happens to have, you know, it was purchased because it's a cultural resource, you know, like the Zen Temple in Weaverville, you know, a very small state park that, you know, really just has a, you know, a building on it that has historical significance. And, you know, in that case, we could say everything we know about it and you'll be, you know, assured that that'll come out. But we can't take thousands of acres and survey them all at once. That wouldn't make any sense.
Yeah. So I was just clarifying that dichotomy and
yeah, it's a good
if it continued. So my next question is, using your example of the bridge, just because a description of a bridge is in the general plan, a general description, there's no guarantee that that bridge or any other version of access to that will necessarily be done under the general plan, right? I mean, it's allowed to be done, but that involves priorities and funding and right, Alex? I mean, so
correct.
You shouldn't assume that if it's in the general plan, it's going to happen. Is that
correct?
Right?
The general plan is what we would like to see the park eventually evolve to, but understanding that there, you know, what's only going to happen is what's feasible or set as priorities or funding is available. And it's a living document for 20 or 30 years. And then the intent is to kind of relook at that again and decide, is that still the goal? And are these still the features? There are plenty of general plans that have features that have been identified and wouldn't make sense or were never pursued.
So then I thought that we were going to vote on the general plan, like at our next meeting, and we'll have
take action.
Hearings. Is that right or not?
Correct. At the next two meetings, the next two hearings for this commission, you will be reviewing a general plan to take action on.
Two different general plans?
Two different general plans, yes.
Okay. But there are action items in both.
They are action cases. Items, yes.
Okay. And my last thing, just to Sarah's point, we had a big workshop with the public, the commission did a year, maybe 2 years ago. It was well attended, lots of comments on things, and those issues, I'm sure, will come up again. They were addressed more in the general plan based on that workshop, but they're still vague. But especially like the traffic problem, that's one of the things I'm sure we'll hear a lot about, because the people who live in the area are so frustrated by the Highway 1 traffic, and they want shuttles so that people aren't just driving from Big Sur to Carmel. And it's addressed in the general plan, but not very specifically. It says that's really something that should be addressed, or some version of that, right, Alex? And so
right,
we'll hear people who want to know, is there going to be a parking lot here or whatever? Mm-hmm. And we just have
right. Yeah, well, when we move to those different general plans and you're at the end, we're having those hearings, those are questions that we can ask the district staff and the planning staff that are available to give, you know, to report on how that's been addressed. Those concerns have been addressed, and they can give a little more on the details. And then the commission can decide if they feel it's been addressed adequately.
Thank you.
Okay. Another way to think about these general plans is kind of as a reservation system, because we are surrounded, of course, by cities and counties all over the state. They'll be doing their general plans. And I like to think that when we do these general plans, and of course, you know, the cities and counties get our notices for, you know, the information sessions, and local staff works with the cities and counties all the time. But one of the things we're doing in a general plan is we're giving notice to the jurisdictions around us of what our plans are. So although it may look pretty general for, you know, let's say the state highway that is impacted by a lot of local traffic and state, you know, related tourist traffic, in basically saying how many people we expect in these state parks and, you know, how they will get along, you will see references to ways to deal with that. And, you know, we expect, and you'll also see recommendations to work with the cities and counties. So, you know, it would be hard to separate out the actual percentage of, I mean, we can stab at it, but it's hard to separate out the actual percentage of what traffic on a state highway goes, you know, is associated with state parks, what is associated with regional tourism, what is associated with state tourism, et cetera, et cetera. And so we are trying to strike in the middle of basically letting other jurisdictions know what we are planning. We are usually part of the solution, so we will be working with those cities and counties on traffic issues. So, you know, we're not going to solve for everything in, you know, a general plan, but we are going to let other people know what we're doing, and we are putting ourselves in a place where we will be cooperative partners with what's going to be done, you know, for that area.
Okay, great. Thank you. Commissioner Mahdi, I think your hand is still up.
Yes. So thank you, Commissioner Mapp. I just wanted to do a plus one to what Commissioner Mapp said on the tribal management piece, or, you know, engaging with tribes. That feels really important and would love to hear more on that. The other question is, it's building a little off of what Commissioner Toy said about community engagement. If, and as one of the new ones on the commission, if, you know, we are reached out to as commissioners by the general public on a particular general plan, what's the best way to engage, relay that information, you know, like sharing that back at our commission meeting makes sense, but are there other ways for us to make sure that those voices are lifted up and incorporated?
So I'll talk a little bit about the tribal communities and consultation. I'll let Catherine tackle the interaction you can and cannot have with the public on individual basis. Okay, so, you know, when we refer to stakeholders, our tribal communities are a major stakeholder. We're required to consult with them on all of our planning efforts. And we have a whole consultation process that happens, point of contacts. We have on our side liaisons, point of contacts on any affected or impacted or, you know, tribes, as well as a statewide consultation. So there's a whole process that we go through for tribal consultation. And it starts right at the beginning of any planning process and carries through to, of course, the very end when this the general plans are presented to the commission. So I can't speak. I'd have to get a tribal liaison to speak specifically on those processes, because we actually have people who are trained in that consultation process, that we work with. But yes, it is a major part of our public and stakeholder outreach.
CEQA also requires that kind of outreach. So it's pretty extensive. That's not to say that things don't fall through the cracks. One of the biggest difficulties is dealing with non-official tribes, you know, tribes that don't have a structure to really work through, you know, who end up at the commission level, you know, when we're looking at things, and all we can really do is continue to work with them, search them out. Our local staffs, you know, one of the great things is that our staffs all live locally, so they know who, you know, to consult with. They're used to consulting with all the different groups, and especially with the tribes. We share a lot of interests with the tribes, especially with archaeology and the cultural aspects. So I think it can always be better, but I think it's pretty extensive. And that's not to say there won't be conflict, because sometimes we're proposing, let's say, an area that could be open for general use, and it's an area that's considered a sacred area for a tribe, where they would prefer not to see any public entrance. So it's a juggling situation, but it's something that we work really hard on. With respect to the public contacting, that's a great question, and I wasn't really going to go into it here, but I think I can be brief in answering that specific question. Bagley Keene basically requires that all communication with commissioners be done in public. That does not mean that individuals cannot contact you. You may have as much or as little contact with the public as you would like to have. Many commissions have what's called an ex parte process, which means that you have to report at the meeting who you talked to and what you talked about. So the Coastal Commission has that. A number of other commissions have that. We do not have that, that particular process. So if the members of the public contact you, I encourage you to talk to them about your level of interest or to facilitate that. It's important that people put their own comments as far as the EIR process in writing to us. There's not really a great way for people to just, you know, come to the meeting. They can come to the meeting, but that will be a little bit late to really get good comments in. So I consider myself, and I think staff does as well, to be part of our responsibility is to inform and educate the public on how to work within the process. So I think that's something you can do. You can lead them towards the website. You can basically work with them on, I find a lot of people are very inexperienced, so they don't even know what to say. This is the first time they're being faced with a general plan for a large park. And so a lot of times they don't even know the questions to ask or how to, you know, kind of get into the process. That's something that all of us can help the public do. You are certainly free to bring those concerns to the commission meetings. We have broad representation in terms of the people of California on this commission. And I think that's one thing that, you know, you're both able and perhaps responsible to do. So does that answer your question? Because that would be an important function on the part of a commissioner. I just hope that you can get it in soon, because just coming to the last commission meeting, as you've kind of heard, does not leave a lot of room, to make big changes in the documents.
Thank you for that, Ms. Tobias. Commissioner Mahdi, are you complete with your question? I see your hand is still up.
I have one more question, and I know Commissioner Bakewell also wants to jump in here. So Alex, you mentioned that the general plans are 20 to 30 years and that, you know, you may want to see this more as like a living document, or the parks want to see this more as a living document. How is that determined? And do we play, as a commission, play a role in that timeline?
Well, let me start with that and then have Alex chime in. We are required to do a general plan when we propose development. So it's a little bit different than cities or counties who kind of reach out and say, you know, we would like to plan this next area for development. As you probably know, in a city or county, a developer could come forward and say, I would like to develop this area. Or the city or county can say, we need to look at our sphere of influence, you know, what direction would we like to grow. We generally, and we usually have a constraint on the funds that are available to do general plans, we generally do a general plan when we are ready to start developing that park. We would hope that in the future we could go out and basically, work and be more anticipatory with getting ready for parks to have a general plan. But up till now, it's really been a situation where, you know, we respond to what districts want to do. So when districts want to basically get something developed, they want to build a visitor's facility, or they want to protect an area that's getting too much use, and they are ready to divide their park into different, preserves and reserves, and they want to separate out their beach areas from perhaps the, you know, canyon areas, then they would propose doing a general plan, and it works its way up in a process of priority to the state level. So it's a little bit different than a city or county. And one of the reasons that the general plans do last so long is that we don't have a lot of pressure to be developing parks. So the ones that are popular, the ones that are closer to urban uses, tend to get, you know, their visitor centers earlier, or, you know, we've got areas in parks in areas of the state that really get very little visitor use, or that are really just, you know, parks that are for camping or hiking or whatever. So there's a little bit of a balancing as to who gets a general plan first. And that's why we came up with these cornerstone documents. Those would be done for each park, you know, regardless of whether they're kind of ready to develop or not, to give us some idea and to give the people some idea of what would be happening in those parks in the future. And Alex, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, I would just say that the cornerstone documents outline the broad vision for the park and the intent for its why it was, you know, acquired. But for general plans, you know, they do have a long life. They're supposed to be a long range planning document. That's the intent. When we look at it, we're supposed to be looking at we're supposed to be looking at generations and generations ahead of how we think these park units are supposed to be being used by the public, or how the public would like to use these units. We do in instances have changes that are major in a park. Maybe there's a huge acquisition that happens that might change the way that park is handled, or maybe some use patterns or something has happened, or maybe a sensitive resource has come up and been discovered that could change the intent or the use of the park. And when those kind of things, let's say I do a general plan and in 15 years we have a huge acquisition, then I would move towards doing a general plan amendment to make those adjustments. Or if there's a demand in a park that that we didn't foresee when the general plan was done in 1980 and now, you know, or 1990 and the park is 20 years old or whatever the case may be, and now we're getting a major demand, we would go back and look and say, okay, do we want to do an amendment to have this campground here that's being requested of us from the public, or do we need to relook at this general plan and either decide to do a new general plan or do an amendment? Typically, if a park already has a general plan, you would just be doing amendments because that general plan still established the purpose and vision of that property. And then we build on that, but we understand that things change, you know, and of course the public's demands over the, you know, evolve and change and the activities evolve and change. I mean, perfect example is bikes and parks, you know. In the 70s, that really wasn't even identified, and now it's a major function in our units. So, you know, we understand that, and we have to be able to evolve with that. And so we do amendments, and in rare cases where maybe a park unit has changed its classification, which goes to the commission first, we redo a general plan to stay consistent with that new classification.
That's all great.
I just want to check in. I had this big aspiration of having a break. At 10:30, it's now 10:49. I would propose that we take 10 minutes and just have a break from screens. I see we have two questions, and if we can come right back to those questions right after and then pick up the agenda, I just, you know, want us to be kind to ourselves.
Yeah, and you do have, Commissioner Chair Ruth, a map, I'm sorry. You do have three questions. Commissioner Bakewell also has a question. He just has.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Okay. Are you three okay with taking the break now? Okay, great. So as soon as we come back, we'll hear from Commissioners Toy, Commissioner Barth, and Commissioner Bakewell, their questions. And then we can move to the next agenda item. Sound okay? All right. So it's 10:50. Let's come back at 11 o'clock. Thank you.
Okay, Chair, we are up and rolling. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Hope you all had an invigorating short break. And I just would like to call us back to order. We are, just for those who might be joining us or rejoining us, we are on agenda item number 6. We've completed that agenda item, and we have questions from the commission and some great discussion, and we will pick up those questions. We have 3 commissioners whose hands are up, and I'd like to go ahead and I'm not sure who was first, but let's...
It's Commissioner Bakewell, but...
Let's do Commissioner Bakewell. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and start with you, Commissioner Toy, then we'll get to Commissioner Bakewell, and then to you, Commissioner Barth. Does that work? Great. All right, let's kick off with questions from you, Commissioner Toy.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up at one my earlier question, which is about the public engagement process, is whether or not the parks ever use or offer resources, materials, or facilitation in languages other than English?
We do, yes. We are getting better at it. We haven't been so great about it in the past, but we are getting better about it, and we do provide documents and information in other languages, depending on...
What triggers that?
Either a direct request at one of the meetings or our awareness that there is a community that has a primary language difference.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, Commissioner Bakewell, I understand you had a question before the break. I'd like to go ahead and give you the floor.
I did. Thank you very much, Chair. We've talked a lot about planning and about the whole process for general plans. This may be out of order. Maybe we can get to this another time. But I really would like to talk about how we're spending the money that we're spending. You know, are we engaging Black contractors? Are we engaging Latino contractors? Are we engaging women? You know, people of color generally, a lot of money. I've been through a few CEQAs, environmental processes, a lot of money, lawyers. And who are we spending our money with? And how much money are we spending? This may be an inappropriate time, but I'd like to get us on that track. I think, you know, just as the last commissioner mentioned about whether or not we're printing any of our stuff in other languages. I think we have to try to broaden our perspective. At least this is just from my perspective. This is my first meeting, so you may have already been on this track, but I certainly want to know what track are we on and make sure that we're being as inclusive as we possibly can be and that we're spending this money with a lot of different people. That's it.
Okay. So we are actually bound to follow state contracting laws. And we have the CEMA, which the California Master Agreement Services, which is a state inventory house, you might say, of anybody who is allowed to provide services to the state of California. They have to go through an application process. It's not really that they apply, it's just that they have to give them information, show that they are residents, or depending on the type of services they're providing, whether or not they live in the state. And we have to go through quite a few contracting requirements depending on different levels of funding that are being expended. So this gets very detailed, and at a future meeting, we could probably have one of our contract specialists come out and give you information on how that works. But there is priority given to companies that work with disabled veterans, or companies that are owned by small businesses that are owned by women, or, you know, so there's a lot of different aspects to the contracting laws that we follow. But at the short of it, we have to follow those laws. Those laws are set up to be as inclusive as possible and to create a selection process, that a bidding process that helps us be inclusive and not selective to anyone.
It's always a bidding process.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
We do anything to source businesses in the various areas where we're getting ready to build a park or expand a park or do anything, do we try to target the communities where we're going to be doing this work?
Well, we can't really do that with the state contracting laws. So depending on the type of services that we're looking for, we have processes that we have to follow. So if I was just looking, let's say, for something that was minor work, under $10,000, and I wanted to put together a flyer or something, and there was a group that I knew that was local that would do great artwork, I've seen it, I think it would be really relevant to the park, I could work with them to do that directly. But if I wanted to do something that was, you know, $100,000, I have to go through the state contracting process, and they have to go through the state contracting process.
Spend time doing today, but I will just tell you, the state's not that good at doing what I'm talking about. So that's my real concern,
yeah,
that we pay some attention to that to the extent that we can. So enough said. Thank you very much for the response.
Thank you, Commissioner Blackwell. Very much appreciate your comments. Definitely incredible food for thought. And I hope we can keep discussing that thread. Commissioner Barth?
I agree. Welcome, Commissioner Bakewell, and I appreciate your questions. On a different aspect of this, I thought I heard Alex say that these plans are meant to be looking out seven generations. And I understand they're to some degree aspirational, right? Because we're trying to imagine something that will last a long time. On the flip side, I'm just thinking about my realistic experience with parks and some of the limitations in terms of resources and feasibility of some of these things. And so I just wondered if either other commissioners or the staff could comment on the balance between evaluating a plan that has grand aspirations and may be wonderful, but in our heart of hearts, we suspect will never be implemented, and how you'd advise us to think about that challenge.
And I just like to clarify a general plan. Our goal at state parks when we're looking at our properties in general is generation seven. One of our initiatives is seven generations. We look seven generations ahead, but the general plans don't actually look seven generations ahead. They do look generations ahead, but not seven, because they're only a 20 to 30 year plan. But we should be looking, we should have a long vision for these park properties. And then the general plan is a small window in that very long vision for these park properties. There is always that concern that, you know, when we're looking at a general plan and we're putting these plans together, you know, we do try to balance that when we're looking at our alternatives. You know, there's always that alternative that is like, we want to be able to do everything we can imagine in this park, but we just know that there's some of that that's just not ever going to be feasible. So we have to bring it back into something that would be more feasible. So we do try to take that into consideration when we're developing a general plan. You know, we're not out there, you know, proposing things that we don't think could ever, ever happen. We hope that whatever we put in that plan will be implemented. But the reality is, it is a planning document, and we all make plans, you know, in our daily lives and on properties and on lands. And sometimes those plans are fully implemented and sometimes they're not. And that is the reality with general plans. You know, the goal that we put it out there is not that we're going to give you a plan that we know will never happen. That's not our goal. Our goal is that we're giving you a plan that we hope will happen. We just have to realize that reality hits, and maybe we'll never be able to put that campsite that we proposed in an area. Or maybe we proposed a campsite in the area, and then 10 years down the line, a cultural resource is discovered there. And so now we will never put the campsite there because there was a resource that wasn't known at the time when the decision was made. So, you know, or the resources have changed in some way. But what I think what's important to remember with general plans is we wouldn't do something that's not in a general plan. So if I proposed a campsite in an area and I proposed it to be a small scale campsite, maybe just environmental campsites, where you biked or hiked in or rode in and it was off a trail area kind of established, you know, that's what we've proposed in a general plan. 10 years from then, I'm looking at that camping, those implementing those camping sites, I'm all of a sudden not going to decide, let's put a full-blown campground here. with toilets, and because people love it, because that's not in the general plan. So it actually kind of provides that protection of what we can and cannot do in the park as well. And you should also be thinking of it in that way, that, you know, I may never be able to get that e-site in there, but I'm not ever going to put in there a full-blown campground without having to do a revision to the general plan and bringing it back to the public and bringing it back to the commission, because that's not what was identified when we looked at the initial purpose and vision for that park. Catherine, did you want to add anything to that?
I think that was well put.
Great. I just want to thank you all, commissioners, for great questions and some generative conversation. And, you know, this is a learning journey. And I just hope we can continue to ask questions, our frank questions, so that we can approve these plans in the best service of Californians and parks. If we can, I'd like to move on to agenda item 7. We are still just a little bit ahead of schedule, which is the resolution process. Are we prepared to go forward with the next agenda item? Okay, over to you.
Great. Thank you. If you could, Bob, if you could pull up the resolution process presentation. And this, this presentation is going to be pretty brief, but knowing that you guys have a couple of general plans coming up, they have multiple resolutions associated with them. So I just wanted to kind of give you a little bit of a review on resolutions and, and what you can expect. So next slide, please. So when actions, can we go ahead and have the next slide, please? Great, thank you. So when actions pertaining to the state park system units are brought to the State Park and Rec Commission for review and approval, the commission decision is formalized through the signing of a resolution. A resolution is a written motion adopted by the commission. The substance of a resolution can be anything from the classification of a park unit to the approval of a general plan or EIR. And for any actions requested of the commission, a draft resolution will be presented at the hearing for consideration and adoptions. Resolutions can include a single action or multiple related actions, and the commission can approve one or more resolutions while revising or rejecting others at the same hearing. Once a resolution is adopted, it is added to the associated planning document and parks data unit file. So if it's a resolution for the approval of a general plan and EIR, that resolution is inserted in the beginning of the general plan and EIR. Next slide, please. The resolutions substantiate the decisions of the State Park and Rec Commission. They are the link to the substantial evidence that the commission considered when making the decision, such as the resource summary in the naming and classification resolution, or a general planning process and its associated resolution. They're very useful in documenting the decision-making process should any action taken by the commission be legally challenged. Catherine, is there anything that you wanted to add to this?
No, thanks.
Okay. Next slide, please. So the resolutions substantiate the decision of the State Park and Rec Commission. They are the link to the substantial evidence. Why did I just reread that? Sorry. So they're the link to the substantial evidence and of course provide that documentation. So I'm not sure what just happened there, but I skipped one. Resolutions, I think I accidentally skipped that slide and I apologize for that, but resolutions can include naming and classifications, general plans and EIRs. They can designate subunit classifications, which we'll discuss in the next session here. They'll also can identify concession arrangements or memorial groves. So you have a variety of different topics of resolutions that the commission does review and approve. And then the last slide, of course. So very brief on the resolutions. But just wanted to give you kind of an idea of what those are, because those are going to be your documents at the end of the day that you end up signing off on. And so I will open it up for any questions from the commission. Sorry, there's those type of resolutions.
Any questions?
No, go right ahead.
Oh, I was just going to follow up with your invitation
yes.
for questions. Okay, seeing that there are no questions on the resolution process, we can move on to agenda item number 8. If you're prepared to discuss now the park naming and classification process.
Great. And Bob, if you can pull up that last presentation for naming and classification, that'd be great. Okay, so once acquired, property becomes the responsibility of the department to manage for its protection of resource values and in many cases provide access for public use. And the need for resource inventories and unit classification is necessary to properly identify and guide management of appropriate visitor activities within the department's guidelines for natural, cultural, and recreational resource management. Next slide, please. A responsibility of the Park and Rec Commission is the classification and naming of park properties. The Public Resources Code establishes several classifications for units in the state park system, and the classification recognizes the prime resource values and sets the general parameters for the type of facilities and activities that would be allowed. No new facilities may be developed on properties that have not been classified, and if classified, only developed if compatible with the classification of the unit. Before classification, the property is typically not referred to as a unit of the state park system. I did provide to you in the staff report the California State Park and Rec Commission standards, statements of policy, policy 2.2, classification and naming units, features, groves, and the trails of the state park system, and suggest that you give that a look over. It gives you some more information on the parameters for naming and classification. Next slide, please. This is the flowchart for the naming and classification process that I would walk through during the, that I'm like to walk through during this presentation. It starts with the identification of the significant resources to a recommendation of the name and classification to the State Park and Rec Commission. As you can see, we have quite a few steps that we walk through before we get to what we actually consider a recommendation for the commission. Next slide, please. When the property is transferred to the state ownership, department staff begins on-site surveys, assessments, inventories, and resource studies. Generally, this is the first opportunity to identify and determine the significant natural and cultural sites and potential recreation opportunities. Knowing the significant values and sensitivities of the natural, cultural, and recreational resources, as well as the historical uses of the land, guides the department's planning staff in determining the appropriate unit classification. This level of resource inventory is intended to provide a broad understanding of the significant resource values and is not a detailed accounting of all sites and features. The inventory of features, which is part of the resource summary document, summarizes the significant resource values of the park property and its culmination of the initial research and site investigations. This inventory will satisfy the requirements of the Public Resources Code 5002.1 and must be included in the document package submitted to the commission for its consideration when classifying or reclassifying a unit. An analysis of the opportunities to provide outdoor recreation facilities for future park visitors and to interpret and protect the natural and cultural resources should be identified. And these opportunities should expand on the purpose of the unit while addressing how the unit will serve the people of California and what constraints or challenges may exist. Following the initial investigations and preparation of the property's inventory of features, department staff will evaluate the information and alternative classification suggestions and make a recommendation for unit classification. The staff recommendation is submitted to the Planning and Acquisition Committee with the inventory of features for review and comment. Districts will often hold a public meeting to obtain public input and feedback from the local community on the possible classification and name for the park property. And we'll review the various I'll be covering those classifications in a few slides. Frequently, units are given a name to which they have been accustomed due to location, association, history, or general usage. Occasionally, land will be acquired into the state park system having deeded restrictions, easements, or naming requirements. Typically, staff will recommend alternative names for consideration, indicating the preferred alternative and providing justification for the preferred name to the commission for their review. Next slide, please. Now, there's two types of properties that we inventory in the state park system. Classified units. These are properties that are specific, legislatively defined. Classification was approved by either the State Park and Rec Commission or, in some rare instances assigned by the to the land by the California legislature. There are two kinds of classified units. The basic unit that collectively form the bulk of the state park system, and the internal classified units that may be located within and as part of basic units. The other is unclassified properties. These are properties that are associated with the state park system but have not been classified by the State Park and Rec Commission as units. Many of these properties are major holdings that will be eventually be classified as individual park units. The others are smaller properties that are being held by the department for various reasons. Virtually all of the department's planning work is applied to classified units. Except as a guide to interim management, relatively little formal long-range planning effort is expended on properties that have not yet gained the classification status. Currently, there are 16 unclassified properties in the state park system. Next slide, please. And as you can see, we have a total of 280 parks, properties in the system. Parks are classified by the commission in one of the 12 possible classifications defined in the Public Resources Code. This includes state parks, state recreation areas, state beaches, wayside campgrounds, and determines the primary focus for management of resources and allowable uses, which provides the framework for preparing a general plan. The slide shows you the different classification types and current number of units in those classifications. Parks are classified in order to identify the nature of unit resources, such as natural, cultural, appropriate, resource-based outdoor recreation opportunities. And the classification indicates a level of emphasis given to the resource protection and facility development and public's use of key resources. The classification categories are described in Division 5, Chapter 1, Article 1.7, from sections 50.19.5 to 50.19.8 of the California Public Resources Code, which was also provided in the staff report. Next slide, please. The Public Resources Code also allows for areas within a classified unit of the state park system to be subclassified as internal units, as either a state wilderness, a cultural preserve, or a natural preserve. The management intent for these subclassifications is to provide for further preservation and protection of significant natural and cultural resources. In preserves, visitor services and improvements are secondary to resource protection, and overnight use is typically non-existent. Any classified unit may have one or more internal units within its boundaries. It should be noted that state wildernesses can be either a classification as well as a subclassification in a classified unit. Areas identified for subclassification do require an approved boundary be defined for the Park and Rec Commission approval. And currently there are 95 subclass units within the state park system. It's important to note that the classification or internal units or subunits may be proposed at any time following the unit classification through a similar administrative process. Generally, subclassifications are identified and proposed during the preparation of a general plan and require a more detailed resource inventory in order to determine resource significant and appropriate boundaries. In such cases, the resource summary in the general plan document and any supplemental resource materials prepared during the planning effort serve as the proposed subunit's inventory of features. Next slide, please. Now, there's five additional classifications available to the state park system units that were created by the Marine Managed Areas Improvement Act of 2000, as identified in the Public Resources Section 5019.8. The assignment of marine classifications to specific properties requires the concurrence of agencies other than the department. In 2010, our first state marine park, Cambria State Marine Park, was classified. There are two state marine reserves, Emeryville Crescent and Albany State Marine Reserve, but they've yet to achieve the concurrence of the corresponding agency from the Fish and Game Commission. Next slide, please. So the department prepares resources and documents to submit to the commission recommending the preferred name and unit classification. The classification document will be submitted to the commission for review prior to the scheduled hearing date. The classification document will include the inventory of features along with the recommended unit name and justification for classification and designation. The primary document required for classification is the resource summary. This document will summarize the most significant resources, values, unit purpose, and potential opportunities for public access and use. It also informs the public as to the nature of the park's key resources and to the opportunities that they can experience there. This classification proposal shall include a discussion of alternatives that were considered and a map depicting the unit boundaries and acreage involved. Maps will also be provided that identify park boundaries, regional contexts, and any resource constraints. A staff report is also provided that discusses the naming and classification recommendation, alternatives that were considered, and any public support or controversies associated with the recommendation. The department will provide proper public notice and make a presentation on the resource, interpretive, and recreational values and classification proposal at a scheduled public hearing of the State Park and Rec Commission, allowing the public an opportunity to provide testimony on the unit classification and name. And following the commission's approval, the project manager shall submit proper notice to all department divisions and other appropriate agency regarding the action, indicating the name and unit classification. This important step will place the new name and classification to department records for accounting and management programs. Next slide, please. And this concludes the presentation on naming and classification process. So I'll now turn it over to the commission chair for any questions or clarifications.
Thank you so much. Now, naming doesn't come up very frequently, but I'll tell you just in the experience that we had, Commissioner Wittenberg, I think you and I were serving at the same time. We were a part of the naming. It's very significant. There's a lot of opinion and public input, and it's a lasting way of telling the story of a place. So I just, you know, cannot emphasize enough, like, even though this part of the presentation was very short, the naming process can be very, very intensive and is so very important. So thank you so much for touching on that. And if there are any questions right now, or Commissioner Wittenberg, if you'd like to speak to what that experience was that we had here in the Trione Park Unit, I would love to share that with especially the new commissioners. Okay. All right. Well, we've got Commissioner Mahdi and Director Quintero. Director Quintero, would you like to jump in?
Have Mahdi go first, please.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Mahdi.
Thank you, Chair Mapp. I'm just curious how the naming, what the relationship is to, you know, I know the parks is undergoing this effort to identify racist markers within park units. What's the relationship? And I know we'll have an opportunity when those units are up for renaming to be able to approve, you know, or not approve those units, the new names, but how is this related to that process?
Well, you're part of that process. The State Park and Rec Commission is part of that process. So, you know, the department is going through an inventory of names of both park units, subclasses, and features within a park. And as we go through that process, there will be areas that are identified where the names should be reconsidered. And if those areas are classified units, subclassification, memorial groves or trails, that comes before the commission for review and approval. The director has approval of features within a park unit, and that typically becomes an internal process. However, I can imagine that some of these will be brought forward to the Park and Rec Commission just because of the public interest. Does that answer your question?
Thank you, Commissioner Mahdi, that you opened up exactly what I wanted to talk about, which is that's a big task that we have ahead of ourselves as we revisit names through the revisiting historic names or reexamining our past. But you know, I just watched a 1 hour interview between an author whose name is Rebecca Solnit with an actress, and it was an amazing interview. But one of the things that Rebecca Solnit talked about, which I had not really considered, and I'm embarrassed to admit this now in this meeting, she was talking about this relative to cities, but how many women's names do we find in parks when it comes to trails and place names? Yeah, it's a really interesting thing to think about. And it, I mean, all kinds of things came to mind for me about that. Not only in terms of names of the first people that we might be using for areas, but I think this group has a really wonderful opportunity to broaden this conversation and to really rethink what we're doing in terms of the contemporary world in which we live and the contemporary world that we're going to pass forward, you know. And in fact, just about an hour ago before this meeting started, I thought, and this comes from this interview that I saw, you know, what if just for fun, for one day, you changed all the names in a park to women's names? You know what I mean? It just, you know, I mean, and I'm just saying this out loud for the first time, not mechanically, not officially, but it's just a matter of just thinking about how we really are inclusive in the work that we do. You know, and so I'm telling me that in front of you, you know, and it's just really an exciting time. And Alex, the framework that you just put forward was really good. And thank you so much for the work you did. And I didn't mean to say something scary there, but it's real. I mean, it's very real. And and in this time of having to restore parks, and pretty significantly, I think we can think about restoration in a lot of ways. And thank you for everything you're all doing in participating in this meeting today. It's really, really critical, and thanks. So I'll stop there. Just wanted to make those comments.
And I don't think that was scary. I was just wondering why only one day.
Well, we have a lot of, and you know, even our language, right? I was going to say, we have a lot of heroes. We have a lot of heroines, right? You know, it's thanks, Alex.
That's great. And I know, I mean, I was made so present to the importance of naming when I went into the Interpretation Center. And I think I've told you the story, Director Quintero, the Marshall Gold Discovery Historic State Park. I went there in the shop, and I started reading about the history of this park, and I learned about the Monroe family and the Gooches, and these were Black people in this park and a part of the country that you would never have connected with, you know, Black wealth. And it was Gold Rush related, right? But the naming of the park didn't include that really important history and influence that family had. And so I read the memorandum that came from the State Park Commission to decide the name of that park. And so, you know, it's incredible how naming a park, you know, has to the point of hearing what we've heard before about the generational reach that decision, I think it was made in the 40s, is one that, you know, is still present to us with us today, and tells a story or doesn't tell a story about who belongs and who was there. So,
and great naming, discussion. Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think, and sorry to jump in.
No, please.
But I think naming is a combination of both a signal and a really strong message, you know. And by message, I mean, and think of this. I mean, think of women walking into a park and seeing women's names on trails and in places. You know, it's a signal, but it's more than that. And really, I think, sorry, I can't put words to what I'm thinking right now. It's an emotional thing, right? It's a belonging. So anyway, thank you so much for this conversation.
That's great. I appreciate it. So I think we now are at the point of the agenda where we are complete with the workshop. And I just want to just acknowledge Ms. Steele and Ms. Tobias for such great content and share that was easy to digest, generated some great thoughts and conversation and questions. And I hope that we can keep coming back to the well of your knowledge as we receive these general plans and figure out how to read them and also how to include the public in a meaningful way. I would love to learn, you know, how we as commissioners can be your partner for public engagement and into the department, how we might use our social and digital tools to alert the public in ways that may not be, so for instance, if you're not on the mailing list already, you know, how do you get this information? And so maybe taking a look at, you know, how we're reaching the biggest audience and making sure that they're aware of opportunities to weigh in is something that I would love to champion alongside you. Are there any other comments before we move into the public comments? But again, thank you so much. And thank you so much, commissioners, for your great, great questions and input. Okay, great. So I'm going to summarize again for those just joining us, the information regarding the public comment period. Each speaker will have 1 minute to present their comments. Please state your name before you present your comments because the commission will only hear your voice since your video will remain muted during this time. Individual speakers may not pool their comments under one person or cede their time to another person to obtain a longer time to speak. We are requesting members of the public who want to provide comments on agenda items and items not on the agenda to use the raise hand option in the Zoom app or dial *9 to raise your hand on a phone. This process will help meeting staff identify you and limit the potential for error. So we've now arrived at public comments, items not on the agenda, and we have about 30 minutes. And I'd love to begin hearing on public comment on items not on the agenda. And at this time, you can use the raise hand option. I'd like to defer to AGP, our technical advisors here to help us with this portion of the meeting. I will also make note that pursuant to legal counsel, the commission may not hold a discussion on these comments that we may hear because the public comments are items not on the agenda. However, the chair may request action from the deputy director or commissioners may make a request through the chair for future action. Do we have any public comments?
Commission Chair Mapp, we have two people registered to give public comment on this topic with raised hands. Participants, public commenters, when it is your turn to speak, I will inform you that you may unmute your microphone and begin. If you have decided not to comment, please say pass. I apologize in advance if I mispronounce your name. You'll have 1 minute to speak. Lynn Paulson, please unmute yourself and begin your 1 minute of comment.
My name is Lynn Paulson, speaking for Sierra Club, California. Common sense and state law require a general plan upon creating a park and prior to the development of any new facilities. State Parks is not fulfilling this requirement for many park units, and this impedes the department's duty to restore, protect, and maintain a park's native environmental complexes as also required by state law. An example is Washoe Meadows State Park, where State Parks has not prepared a general plan for 37 years. unreasonably. They have placed a priority on the adjacent Lake Valley State Recreation Area and its environmentally damaging golf course. Washoe Meadows has been had issues which threaten the survival of one of its important fens. Only one other California state park is known to have a fen, McCarricker State Park. McCarricker has both the general plan and a fen resource management plan, and these plans are long overdue for Washoe Meadows. We ask the commission to intervene and compel state parks to fulfill its legal duties to protect irreplaceable park resources at Washoe Meadows and the 73 other park units without a general plan. Thank you very much.
Mike Garabedian, please unmute yourself and begin your minute of comment.
Good day, commissioners. Mike Garabedian, Friends of the North Fork, American River, and Placer County Tomorrow. Thank you for this excellent workshop. I followed the Auburn State Recreation Area since since 2004, been involved with it, the process since then. It is very hard to imagine the commission taking up this 66-square-mile park without a site visit. I hope that that can somehow be arranged. Just a listing of critical areas, their rim housing, it's a visual blight on the park. It's a major issue that has and hasn't been addressed in the past by different directors there. The North Fork Trail is a major issue that has been through several processes, it probably deserves a different designation. There's a motocross track that's been washed out twice and been rebuilt. There's severe fire hazards. There was a public survey, a heavy public user survey that's been ignored by the plan by and large. And finally, industrial development is even an issue. So thank you.
Norma Santiago, please unmute yourself and begin your minute of comment. Ms. Santiago, you might be muted.
Good afternoon. Norma Santiago, Sierra State Parks Foundation, Board President. Again, thank you for this workshop. There are some issues that I'm concerned about in terms of particularly Washoe Meadows State Park. It is part of the parks that are under our cooperative association responsibilities. Anyway, how we begin the process, how do we become engaged in the process is one of my key questions. I didn't see an opportunity to ask this question during the course of the workshop, but the biggest thing is how do we petition state parks to engage in developing a general plan for a particular state park? That's the first question. And how can that be funded by a cooperative association?
Chair Mapp, all people in public comments have been heard or did not respond. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well ahead of schedule, we are now at the adjournment at just ahead of 12 noon. I'm sorry, there's a hand up. Mike Garabedian. Has this person already been heard? Thank you very much. This has been, again, such an informative meeting. I'm very much looking forward with this new body of commissioners to dig into these general plans and with all of the due diligence and tools that we were presented with today. Commissioners, please join me again in thanking you know, Ms. Tobias and Ms. Stell for, you know, a really well put together and informative workshop that's only going to help us be successful in approving and vetting general plans. So unless there's anything further from anyone, the State Park and Recreation Commission meeting is hereby adjourned. Thank you.